Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Noel Gallagher, songwriter, singer and guitarist. He was the creative engine of the massively successful era-defining band Oasis and has built a highly regarded career in the 6 years since their infamous split. Oasis had multi-million album sales and record-breaking concert appearances and won piles of awards, 6 Brits and 2 Ivor Novellos among them. So far, so rock star. But in truth, his explosive relationship with his brother Liam, the band's lead singer, generated nearly as much interest as the music they made together. They grew up in Manchester in difficult circumstances. Their father was violent and money was short. Their mother bought Noel's first guitar from a catalogue, repaying the 30 quid it cost in weekly instalments. He says music is a thing that changes people's lives. It has the capacity to make young people's lives better. You've got a duty to make music. If you can, you shoot. So, Noel Gallagher, when did that first occur to you, this idea that music changes people's lives? Was it when you were listening to it and it was changing yours, or when you were making it and it was changing other people's?
I guess the latter. The statement that I made there was only made relatively recently. And, you know, the songs that I play have been around for 20 years, and there's people who were teenagers at my gigs who weren't even born when they were coming out, and they sing these songs like their lives depend on it. And you just think, what an amazing thing to be able to be involved in that in some part, whether playing it or writing it or performing it. I still find it a magical thing.
It's a very difficult thing to explain, the creative process, but as you go through that process of writing a song, do you know it's a biggie? Do you get that feeling?
There is no golden rule, but there are kind of little signposts that you recognise. If a song comes quickly, it usually means it's good because it's just fallen out of the sky. Don't Look Back in Anger took, you know, 15 minutes. If I'd have known that night that that song would live for so long and become such a thing, I would never have finished it, because it would never have been perfect enough to think, oh, in 25 years people are going to be playing this at their weddings, and you know what I mean? It was just another song. And then sometimes a song will require a lot of thought and purity of emotion, you know. And then some songs are just nonsense that I just throw away, but they're a great tune. And I think if I spend too much time thinking about it, I'll take away all the magic. You know, I still believe there's just somebody up there and they're just dropping songs all over the place. And if I'm not ready to catch them, Chris Martin's getting them and Bono's getting them, and they've had enough, you know. There's no way they're getting them. So I do it every day, you know what I mean? I'm there every day fishing in the river for the songs, you know.
Let's go to the list. It will be much pored over, I'm sure. Tell me about the first one we're going to hear this morning.
Well, the first track is by the Sex Pistols, and it's a track called Pretty Vacant. I would have been 8 or something, and I remember being on the high street, Burnies Lane, where I come from, and seeing a guy with a peroxide skinhead kind of hairdo, and he had an exclamation mark sprayed on the back of his head. And I remember being with my mum and thinking, wow, what's that? And I loved it because the music was great. And it's a great pop album. They changed everything. And it was the rebirth of youth culture that was dead. It was pretty much dead.
Pretty Vacant from the Sex Pistols. So, Noel Gallagher, you have been in the public spotlight now for around about 20 years. You have been with the woman who's now your wife, Sarah, for 15 years. You're a father of three. You've just celebrated your 48th birthday.
I have indeed. Thank you for mentioning that.
You are welcome. the idea of being this sort of anti-establishment hellraiser, you can't do that anymore when you're at your stage. You know, the middle-aged rock star thing, it's a tricky one.
Yeah, I don't really chase my youth, do you know what I mean? I had a great youth. It was brilliant. I don't dye my hair. I don't wear earrings. I haven't got any tattoos. I'm not bothered about chasing the girls and all that. I'm in it for the work, you know. And if you did what I did, why wouldn't you do it?
I once read you say in an interview, there's a golden sort of four-year period when you are making music for people who are just like you because you're still living the same life as the people that you're making music for.
Yeah.
Now, when you write music, how do you manage to still keep an enthusiasm and a sort of purity to that creative process that there was, you know, back in the beginning?
You just have to stay true to yourself. And, you know, when I was writing our first album, I was writing songs about wanting to be a rock star and wanting all the things that came with it, the fast life and all that. Clearly, if you're writing songs like that when you're my age, you become a bit of a knob, do you know what I mean? There has to be a certain kind of truth in everything that you write. Even if it's just one line in a song that's truthful to you and your situation. And if it's true to you, then it's going to be true to somebody else, you know. And I tend to write songs now, if they're about anything, they're about the journey of life, I suppose.
Tell me about your next song that we're going to hear now then, your second disc.
This is one of my favourite songs of all time by David Bowie, who I put right up there with John Lennon and Bob Dylan and all the greats. In the mid-80s, I suppose, we used to be round at my friend's flat, Paul Kelly, his name was, and we were all on the dole. And the difference between dole culture then and dole culture now is there was nothing to do during the day. Now it's like you can sit in all day and live off benefits, smoking, you know, watching Cash in the Attic. Then you kind of had to amuse yourself, you know, with magic mushrooms and, you know, this, that and the other. But at the night time, after TV had finished, there would be like Prisoner Cell Block H. Psychedelic. And I vividly remember one night, there was this thing on that was called the 5-Minute Profile, David Bowie. And I'd never taken much notice of David Bowie. He didn't really mean a great deal to me. And I'd never heard the track Heroes before. And it blew my mind. I was like, wow, this is amazing. And the only reason that I'm not going to play the track Heroes is because my wife, the lovely Sarah, said to me this morning, you are going to play Let's Dance by David Bowie, aren't you? And I said, well, I'm going to play Heroes. And she said, play Let's Dance. You make me listen to it 3 times a week. You've ruined the song for me. I now hate it because you play it so much. Don't go on Desert Island Discs and not play it.
That was David Bowie and Let's Dance. Your brother Paul once said of you, Noel Gallagher, that you are a person who doesn't encourage closeness. Do you agree? Do you agree with him?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Don't know. My two brothers, to say the three of us come from the same womb, we are all completely different people. I mean, as you can imagine, me and Liam are vastly different.
Your happiest memories were the 6 weeks every year you would spend in County Mayo, and was it Charlestown?
Charlestown, yeah. And it is as rural as you can imagine. My grandma's house, for a long time, didn't even have electricity, but we loved it. Right. Some uncle would always drive us there from Manchester, so you'd get in a car and drive to Holyhead. And this is true, what used to happen was when we used to get to the ferry, they used to put the children on the floor of the car, put blankets over us so we didn't have to pay. That's how poor we were. So we would jib the ferry. It was great. Summers were endless, you know, it was brilliant.
I said in the introduction that there was a violent childhood. Is that fair and is that what you remember?
Well, no, I mean, if you can't, you know, compared to what my children's childhood is going to be when they grow up, yeah, it's horrific. But I will say that my childhood and upbringing and relationship with my dad was no different to any of my friends that I grew up with. That's just the way that it was in the 70s. In the 70s and 80s as well. They were gloomy, dark, fractured times, you know what I mean, for work. And the modern man had yet to be born, you know what I mean? Men were men and the women were at home and all that. And it was, they were rough, but that was just the way it was.
Yeah. A poverty-stricken childhood is one thing. It's not the case that everybody's subject to significant amounts of violence from their dad. That's not the case.
No, that's not the case. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that you would talk about, but I'm an open book, you know what I mean? And I've got, I don't know why I mentioned it in the first place back in the 90s, but there you go.
Do you feel that now? Do you feel you'd actually much rather that genie was back in the bottle and it's nobody's business anyway?
No, not at all. I,
how do you think it marked you? What do you think?
I think, I'm not sure it did. I have to say, I was a bit concerned when I started to have children and I was thinking, what kind of dad am I going to be? Because I haven't got anything to base this on apart from my old fella, who was a bit rubbish. So I was thinking, how am I going to be? And I mean, I don't need to blow my own trumpet here, but I have got a few mugs that say best dad in the world. I mean, they wouldn't buy them for no reason, would they? But I love being a dad, you know. I think it benefited me in the way that it made me withdraw into my own world. And from that came the learning to play the guitar. And from that sparked the whatever it was that made me persevere with it and persevere with it until, you know, I become who I am, you know. So let's put it this way. I've never felt the need. I don't write about it in my songs. I've never felt the need to go and see somebody about it. That's just the way it is, you know.
Let's have your third disc, Noel Gallagher. What are we going to hear?
I'm going to play a track by Pink Floyd from the album The Wall. I know every single word. I can sing it in sequence at the drop of a hat. And Roger Waters, to me, I'd love to meet him. The songwriting is so simple, and yet the story is so grandiose and the whole thing is so epic. I wish I could write an album like that, you know, like a concept album. I think I'd have to get extremely pretentious first, you know. But this track called Nobody Home, it bends my head. I've probably ripped it off at least 3 times, I can recall. If you're listening, Roger Waters, I am going to lick your face one day.
I've got a little black book with my poems in. Got a bag, got a toothbrush and a comb in. When I'm a good dog, they sometimes throw me a bone. I got elastic bands keeping my shoes on. Got those swollen hand blues. I got 13 channels of shit on the TV to choose from.
That was Pink Floyd and Nobody Home. So, Noel Gallagher, New Order, The Fall, The Smiths, Joy Division, Buzzcocks, Manchester's Factory Records was not short of stars. And there you were, growing up in among it all. Tell me about Mr. Sifter's record shop in Burnage.
It was the local record shop. It wasn't called Mr. Sifter's. I named him Mr. Sifter. And Saturday afternoon used to be just hanging round there. And I vividly remember buying Stand and Deliver by Adam and the Ants, right? And it came when it wrapped in a poster. And it said on the corner of the poster, limited edition, first 750,000 include free poster. The first! The first 750,000! I mean, you're lucky if you can shift 750 of anything these days. I bought my first Beatles records from there. You could sell him records and swap him records. It was great.
And how did you do at school?
I mean, I didn't mind school. I wasn't very good at it, which is always frustrating. What is interesting, though, is I clearly had a talent for music. And my music teacher, if you're listening, you know, your job was to spot potential, you know. I freely admit I was barely there anyway. But aren't teachers supposed to drag it out of you? I do remember having a moment in woodwork followed by French one day, thinking, I'm never going to need to speak French. I know for a fact I am never going to have to learn what the meaning is between the feminine and the male version of a French sentence. That is nonsense. This is not for me, you know.
Did you feel you were bound for greatness? Some people say they feel they know that's coming.
No, not at all.
No.
I loved music. That of that I was sure, and I loved the people that made it and the clothes and all that. But no, I wasn't one for standing in front of the mirror with a tennis racket thinking one day I'm going
to
make it.
Well, because I wanted to ask you about that performance thing, because there, you know, you were as part of Oasis in 1996. You did two sellout nights at Nebworth to playing to 250,000 people. Mm. And it was only 4 years earlier that you'd been, it was at the Boardwalk, playing to 100 people.
Yeah, I'd only signed off 3.5 years before that.
So were you always comfortable with the idea of a kind of stage presence? Was that just there?
I certainly don't remember being overawed by it. At all. When we started that band, for 2 years, we were rubbish, you know what I mean? The songs that I were writing weren't great. Until one day I wrote a song called Live Forever and it all changed. And then I wrote another three maybe the next week that would be on the first album. I knew then that I knew enough about music and the songs, because I had a massive record collection, that these were pretty good. But even then, we didn't send tapes out to record companies. We weren't chasing it, do you know what I mean? Yeah. I always felt that if it was going to happen, they would come to us, and they did. And I guess it helps when you're in a band with your brother. That would become the Achilles heel in the end, but Alan McGee owned the record label, he loved us. And when you're in that position and you've got the love of the entire nation behind you, I can't begin to tell you how much of a thrill it is. It's unbelievable.
Let's have some music, Noel. We're on your fourth. Tell me about this.
The Smiths. One of the only jobs I've ever had was in a screen printer's firm, and the radio was always on. And I remember the Smiths coming on one afternoon, and it was like, wow, what's that, you know? I love this track because it was their first single, and it's got a colour to it. They're so important to music in this country, particularly alternative music.
Do you get on with Morrissey?
He's brilliant. The last time I was out with him was in LA. Jaw was sore from just laughing at him, and mainly because he was bullying Russell Brand. This is Hand in Glove by The Smiths, one of the greatest songs ever written.
That was The Smiths and Hand in Glove. Did you get on with Liam as a child?
Yes. Yeah, he was an irritant because we shared a bedroom. And when you're 10 and your brother's 5, that's a lifetime away. So I never hung out with any of his friends. But yeah, we got on.
Because your mum said, you know, they always got on fine until they were in a band together.
Yeah, I mean, look, when I was saying before about you can gain some kind of strength from being in a band with a family member when everybody else around you is a complete stranger. Like I also said, as time goes on, that becomes your Achilles heel because you know how to push each other's buttons. And when family members are arguing, everybody tends to leave the room. So the differences that we would have, whether it be with the music or the band or what video we were doing, would never get resolved because nobody would say, look, well, actually, you're right. Everyone would just casually, one at a time, leave the room until you were just stood there arguing about something that was then became completely irrelevant, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, in fact, I know I annoyed him greatly. And I know he annoyed me greatly.
You see, there's the thing. You know, to watch it from afar, we saw these people at the centre, these people being Oasis, of this enormous wave of popularity. As I said, it's not an overstatement to say you defined a moment in British cultural pop history. And yet you were at each other like cat and dog. And it seemed, was there a time when you did put your arms around each other and say...
Oh, no, we're never that kind of family. No. There's no. There's no arms around each other and saying, you're great. Oh, no, but you're great.
But there's a difference between that and knocking lumps out each other, isn't it? Somewhere in between, there might be a happy medium.
The way it worked was when we're not slagging each other off, that's when we're telling each other that we love each other.
OK, that's enough.
That's it. I mean, you'd have to interview Liam. I don't know. But clearly, there was a point where he was the greatest singer in the world. And it was great. And it just so happens that the two of us, we like to call a spade a spade. There's no hatred involved. It was very sarcastic, you know, mudslinging. We like all that. I still like it to this day. It's fun. All people are not the same. And if all people were the same, the world wouldn't go round. Do you know what I mean?
Let's have some music, Noel Gallagher. We're on your fifth. Tell me about choosing this.
So, after punk rock, which was the second youth culture explosion, the third one, which was Acid House in 1987, took place at a nightclub, the Hacienda. It was a 40-second walk from my house. And I remember going there one night and, of course, never having done ecstasy and thinking, this is nonsense. What is this music? There's no words. It's just a drum machine and I can't hear anything else. And then taking ecstasy and going back and thinking, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. The music I still love to this day. But the track that I'm going to play is by a guy from Manchester called Gerald. He actually goes under the name of a guy called Gerald. And it's a track called Voodoo Ray. Radio 4 listeners of a certain age might well want to go and put the kettle on because this ain't going to make a great deal of sense to you. But all you ex-ravers out there, you know, whoop whoop.
Called Gerald with Voodoo Ray. So, Noel Gallagher, between 1993 and 1998, you were signed by Alan McGee, famously of Creation Records. Definitely, maybe was at the time the fastest-selling UK debut ever. You toured America amid sort of various degrees of chaos. You played at Nebworth, which we've already mentioned, to 250,000 people. And you have said previously that you can't really very clearly remember very much about that five-year period. Is that, I mean, it's a nice line, but is it true?
Genuinely now, if I close my eyes, I can't remember walking on stage at Nebworth. I know it took place because there's lots of people there.
What do you think about that now?
What people are refusing to accept is the 90s was brilliant. Do you think back now to that time of fashion and politics, Thatcherism being ushered out and New Labour being ushered in, and Oasis and Blur and Pulp and all those bands being in the top five all the time.
And what about the night that there was the Cool Britannia so-called party at Downing Street? There was a picture of you and Tony Blair. When you look back, what are your feelings about that?
My feelings are, I mean, I love watching history programmes, right? And there's no way I'm not walking through the doors of Number 10, if only to see what's in there. I'd moved to London in 1994, 3 years earlier, with a hold all, right? With an acoustic guitar, nothing. 3 years later, I drove to Number 10 Downing Street in a Rolls Royce, drinking champagne. We laughed all the way up there, me and Alan McGee. He'd worked at British Rail most of his life, you know. And we were laughing, going, how do we get here? This is amazing, do you know what I mean? And afterwards, you find out that, yes, they did want that photograph. I wasn't so, you know. We helped to usher in Labour. You're welcome, all of you. They were great days.
So when does it stop being fun? When's the point at which you think, you know, this, the joke's over with this, and suddenly the things that seemed like a brilliant idea no longer feel like a brilliant idea?
In 1998, we put out three albums in 3 years, become the biggest band in the world, and all of it was on drugs. Not all of Oasis were on drugs, you know what I mean? Just effectively me and Liam, you know what I mean? And when I lived in London, my house was party central and it was great and I loved it. I'd sold that house in London and moved out to the country. But what happened then is instead of people being in my house and leaving at 6 o'clock in the morning, they'd be in, out the house in the country and would stay for 2 days. And I remember waking up one afternoon, going downstairs, going to the fridge, just getting a beer out, and a complete stranger walking through the kitchen. And I said, oh, okay, who are you? And he said, well, we were here with whatever her name was last night. Oh, right. So there was still a party going on. And I remember getting stuck in to more chemicals and then having just a... I don't know what it was. It was a moment of clarity. And just thinking, I'm not doing this anymore. I felt weak and burnt out. And then I had another moment in the second month where I was out and I wasn't drinking and I wasn't using drugs. And I just thought, I'm not saying it to them. I was kind of thinking, I don't like you. I don't like your bird. She's annoying. I don't like you. Who are you anyway? And I was thinking, I've got nothing in common with these people. And then that was it. I've got quite good willpower. And I thought, I'm not doing it anymore. And I haven't since, you know. And it's one of the greatest things I've ever done. And soon after that moment, I met Sarah.
Hold that thought.
I will do.
But for now, I'm going to ask you about your sixth piece of music. Tell me about this then.
This is a track called With or Without You by U2. The Joshua Tree, that album, at the time was just another record. You listen to it now and it's honestly, easily one of the greatest batches of songs any band have ever written. I love U2. And I don't know. If you don't get it, you don't get it. And shame on you for not. But this is With or Without You by U2, one of the greatest songs ever written. Are you listening, Paul Weller?
My hands are tied. Body bruise, she got me with nothing.
That was With or Without You, U2's track from the Joshua Tree. Three children then, two yes. boys and also a teenage daughter yes. from your first marriage. It sounds like as simple as the love of a good woman is why you sit here today, a sort of clear-headed, happy man.
Absolutely. I met Sarah in a nightclub in Ibiza, which you're not supposed to meet your future wife.
No, you're not.
In a nightclub in Ibiza. If I could think of one person I'd rather go out clubbing with, be Sarah. One person I'd rather go and have a boozy lunch with, it would be her. She's been an amazing stepmom to my eldest child, Aeneas. I don't ever envisage life without her. She's everything to me.
By your own admission, you're somebody who's difficult to get to know. You're very straight talking. How does she keep you in check? What's the...
Because she's worse. Oh, she calls a spade as well. When I'm working on music or writing songs, I do demos, she's the last person I play them to. Because I can play a song and go, get on this. I think this is going to be an amazing tune. You listen to it and go, yeah, it's all right. Do you know what? I never believed in love at first sight or that soulmate thing until I met her. And we've been together 15 years, but we only decided to get married after 11 years. And the song I'm going to play next was the song for our first dance at our wedding. And I remember sat in the kitchen and she says, what about Be My Baby? For the first dance. And I was like, the first what? The first what? And she said, the first dance. You know, when the bride and groom, when you play the first song and they dance. You know, they dance as a couple in front of everyone. And I'm like, whoa, hang on a minute. I'm not sure about that. And she says, it's what happens and it's happening. So get over it. And I've got to say, I was dreading that moment coming up. You know, I was like, I've got to dance like an adult. And I said to her, just do me one favour. When we get on there, don't show off. Because I'm clearly a northerner and a man. And she says, no, don't worry about it. See, what happens is people join in at the first chorus. And I was thinking, Be My Baby, the first chorus has got to be within the first 30 seconds. How bad can it be? So it starts. And she breaks into, like, Olivia Newton-John doing You're the One That I Want. And I'm just looking at her thinking, really? You're going to do this to me in front of all my friends? Now, luckily enough, my daughter, Aeneas, bless her, she realises what's going on. She can see her old fella sinking and she leads a charge onto the dance floor. And I kind of grab over Sarah and I'm kind of thinking, I don't know. She's like, oh, come on, you grumpy bastard. So this is Be My Baby by the Ronettes. And Sarah, I still haven't forgiven you.
Just wait and see. For every kiss you give me, I'll give.
was the Ronettes and Be My Baby. So Oasis then came to a sort of stuttering halt, I suppose, in 2009 when you and your brother went your separate ways and decided that you were no longer compatible as a team working together. And so you've produced, since the split, two albums with your own band, Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. How does it feel, or indeed do you feel and do you know that your biggest selling work is behind you? Because it would surely be impossible to relive those moments of, you know, 22 million album sales for one single album and all of that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I don't mind that. I'm just glad.
Do you not mind that?
I'm glad I did it. No one's going to sell 22 million of anything these days. My first solo record sold nearly a million records in England.
Critically, but very well received. Does that, I mean, is that important?
That doesn't mean a great deal to me. The only critics that matter are the ones on the internet. I mean, the ones that say, I bought it. I'm not, let's put it this way, I'm not as revered a songwriter by the press as Tom York or Damon Albarn, OK? That's just a fact, you know what I mean? And that's great.
Well, where do you put yourself?
I'll tell you when I finished. People used to always ask me about Oasis, and I always used to say, I'll tell you what I think about it when it's finished. And it's only now I can look back and I can say, right, well, there's a definite full stop at it. I can now tell you what I think of that.
And what do you think of it?
I thought that on our day, we were great. And it's reaffirmed every night I go on stage and I play a couple of Oasis tunes. And like I said at the top of the show, people are there that weren't even born and they're crying. You know what I mean? They're crying. And I'm thinking, it's not that bad, surely, you know. You know, all over the world, people still are in massive love with that band. And none more so than me, do you know what I mean?
I'm going to cast you away to this island, which is an almost unbearable cruelty. What will you miss?
Sarah and the kids goes without saying. I mean, I know it's a sad thing to say, but probably match of the day.
Tell me about your final piece of music, Noel Gallagher.
Can't really go through this without mentioning the Beatles. The first guitar that I ever bought when I actually had some money was an Epiphone, was what they used to play. They mean a great deal to me musically. They're just the greatest thing in music that ever was, I think. And as I'm looking down this list now, apart from the Ronettes and Roger Waters, I've met everybody on that list. I've met and hung out with all the Sex Pistols. I've met David Bowie a couple of times. I know Morrissey and Johnny Marr. I've met a guy called Gerald. I know Bono. Do you know what I mean? I've had a beer with Neil Young. Neil Young. He was at Woodstock. And that even all those people, they know your name in advance, is mind-blowing to me, from just like a lad from a council estate who just happened to persevere with the guitar long enough that he made something of himself. This is Ticket to Ride by the greatest band of all time, the Beatles.
The Beatles and Ticket to Ride. I'm going to give you the books now, Noel Gallagher. We give everybody a copy of the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take another book along too. What's your book going to be?
I've only read one novel, which is On the Road by Jack Kerouac. And what I got from reading it was a greater understanding of Bob Dylan.
Right, well, that's your book then. Everybody gets to take a luxury, but I should preface it by saying that Russell Brand wanted to take you to the island stuffed.
Yes,
yeah. You might want to bear that in mind.
He only took me stuffed because that's the only way that he can get the better of me. Can I take a guitar?
Oh, definitely.
And I will sneak a plectrum in with that.
Yeah.
Because if I've got a guitar, that's me. I'm so glad that I persevered with it. I'm not going to push my kids toward music, but I have musical instruments lying around the house. There's like little kids' keyboards and there's a drum kit, various guitars. And that's how I started. I've never had a musical lesson. Yeah, so I'd like to take a guitar, please.
It's yours and the plectrum too. If the waves were to threaten to wash away your discs, we ask everybody to just pick one disc that they would run to save. Which would yours be?
I'm going to say Be My Baby by the Ronettes, because it would make me smile and clench my fists at the same time and think, I still haven't forgiven her for that. Oh, boy, I do love her.
Noel Gallagher, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.